This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington.
Don't shoot! Don't shoot!
It happened 4 years ago. Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson shot and killed an unarmed black teenager. The young man, Michael Brown, laid in the street for 4 hours. Weeks of protest followed, with thousands of demonstrators from Ferguson and beyond. Police fired tear gas. Deployed riot squads.
From protesters and media, please evacuate the area.
And they even set up a so-called five-second rule, where anyone who stood still for more than 5 seconds was arrested. How did DeRay McKesson go from Minneapolis to Ferguson, Missouri? Those protests and the police response to them caught McKesson's eye. He was a community organizer from Baltimore working for the Minneapolis Public Schools. He drove from Minnesota to Missouri, 9 hours each way, to protest. Soon, he was making that trip a lot, and eventually he quit that job and moved to Missouri to organize full time. Today, 4 years later, activism is just part of McKesson's identity. He also hosts the podcast Pod Save the People. He ran unsuccessfully to be the mayor of Baltimore, and his new book is called On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope. DeRay McKesson, welcome to 1A.
It's so good to be here.
Tell us about the book's title, On the Other Side of Freedom. What's the title about? What are you trying to say there?
Yeah, you know, I used to travel much more around the country talking to young people, talking to older people. And what I realized is that we have a deep understanding of this side of freedom. So we know on this side of freedom, a third of all the people killed by strangers, killed by police officers, we know that we arrest more people for marijuana than all violent crimes combined. We know so much about this side of freedom, and we have a lot of work to do, that I wanted to talk about, like, how do we get to the other side of freedom? What does it look like? What does it feel like? How do we get there? What's the strategy and the plan? Because I know that when I think about what freedom is at its core, it's not only the absence of oppression, but the presence of justice and joy, that we can get rid of all the bad things, and that doesn't mean that the good things automatically come to bear. We have to fight for those. So that was where the other side of freedom came from. And then the case for hope is that I think that hope is the fuel for all of this, that hope is a belief that our tomorrows can be better than our todays. And when people say the system is broken, and then in response, some people say, oh, no, it was designed to be like this. My takeaway is that it was designed. And because people made it up, we can make something better. And that is the work of hope.
There are a lot of questions that our listeners wanted to put to you about the work that you're doing, about the Black Lives Matter movement, and so on. I definitely want to ask you about today's political scene. But before we dive into all of that, I'm just kind of curious to know how you are. You've been a very busy dude for the last 4 years. How are you? How is life treating you?
You know, I'm okay. It's I do a lot of interviews, and nobody ever asked me that, so I appreciate that. I'm good. I think that, like, I'm happy about being around the people I knew before the protests and people that I know really well. I got to see my sister the other day, and she's great, and her two kids, so that was good. I think where I am, too, is trying to figure out, like, what does public disagreement about this work look like? That I know that our ideas can be in conflict without us being in conflict. I don't know if everybody sees it like that, but I find myself more and more, like, embroiled in these things that just aren't necessarily true, but take up a lot of room. Like, anytime I tweet about any product, people think it's, like, sponsored, and it's not. But you'd be surprised at, like, the number of, like, messages and emails and da-da-da that I get when I'm like, I got chicken nuggets today, and they're like, why are you shilling for McDonald's? And you're like, come on, guys. But I get it enough that it's actually not fringe, you know? It's like real people say it to me in person, like those sort of things, and that is really weird. So, but I'm good otherwise. We have so much work to do. I'm proud of the work that we've been doing. We have some projects that haven't launched yet that we're working on quietly. And we spend most of our time trying to think about the things that don't make the news, right? So, like, did you know there was an earthquake in Haiti the other day? I didn't know. Like, that is big news. There's only one abortion clinic in all of Missouri. I didn't even know there were 7 states with only one abortion clinic, right? So There are all these things that we try and focus on that people just don't, they don't make the news, but they're incredibly important. And that's what gives me joy right now.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the things that have been going on lately. You came to the nation's attention as a result of these protests in Ferguson, Missouri, as we mentioned. Protest has come up a lot in the last few years as a result of the current administration. The president has opined on the campaign trail and, as president, some of his views on how protesters should be treated. Early last month, the president told reporters in his words, quote, "I think it's embarrassing for the country to allow protesters. In the old days, we used to just throw them out. Today, they just keep screaming," unquote. That was in response to dissenters at the Senate hearings for Supreme Court nominee, now Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Now, protest is protected by the First Amendment, so we can't just throw protesters out. But what do you make of kind of the public conversation around protest today?
Yeah, we see that when it's people of color in the street that everybody thinks protesting is the worst thing in the world. Trump didn't have these same comments when it was the white supremacists in Charlottesville, right? That in Charlottesville was so wild about Charlottesville, besides the tiki torches and besides the guns, was how, I don't know if you saw the footage of the white supremacists literally pushing the police, like as a group pushing the police. It's like, that is, I couldn't even imagine. You know, I've been in many places, in many streets, and none of them could I imagine black protesters physically pushing the police in groups and it not ending in bloodshed. Like, I just don't even know what that looks like. So what we see here is like the not so thinly coded language about like what happens when people of color push back and say that this isn't working. You know, that's sort of the thing about the right, is that the right is just repackaging old messages with new language. And we've seen, you know, laws for a long time that were like, people of color can't assemble, people of color can't be in any groups like that. He's just like repackaging that for this time, that like when it's white people doing it, he hasn't said the same thing.
So that, I guess, gets to some of the critique about what folks saw in the weeks of demonstration in Ferguson, where some described it as unrest or even riots, that you feel like there's a more of a racial component there than some of the critics may themselves realize?
Oh, yeah. You know, people always ask me if I'm over-exaggerating the impact of Twitter. And it's like, Twitter literally saved our lives. That, like, you have to remember that in 2014, there was no Periscope, there was no Facebook Live, Instagram Live, like, none of that. The only live streaming was, like, Ustream. And that was, like, people had to pay to use it. So like Twitter was like the mechanism. And if you remember that the first city that you saw, do you remember the first city that you saw aerial footage of the protests at?
The first city.
That you saw aerial footage.
I don't remember the first city. No, I remember seeing it and being stunned by it, but I don't remember the first city.
It was Baltimore. You didn't see any, you've never seen any aerial footage of the protests in St. Louis because they declared a no-fly zone immediately. So, like, Mike got killed on the 9th, and they declared a no-fly zone, like, on the 12th. So, like, there was no way for you to see what's happening if it wasn't people who were on the ground. And I think one of the things that, like, worked to our benefit is that the media came, and you're right, the language was, like, the rioters, like, you know, black people are being dramatic in the street, and, like, da-da-da. And then the police were, like, indiscriminately wild. Like, I remember when Don Lemon got tear gassed, and it was one of those moments where, like, he was one of those people on the news sort of equivocating about the police, and then he just got tear gassed, and he's like, no, the protesters were right. We're like, yes, we knew we were right, right? Or, like, you brought up the five-second rules, that people don't remember that it was illegal to stand still in August, September, and October 2014, that if we stood still for more than 5 seconds, we were arrested. Like, that's why we marched all day, not because we thought marching was, like, the most effective tactic. Like, we had to march. And, like, people forget those things. And I never want to, like, lose sight of how fragile freedom is. And that was one of the big takeaways from being in the street for the initial wave of the protests in St. Louis.
We're speaking to DeRay McKesson. His new book is called On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope. We got a number of voicemails from some of our listeners about you and your work. Andrew in Atlanta left this in our inbox.
Hey, DeRay, huge fan. Just wanted to say, how do you respond to criticism from your opponents when they say just outlandish, ridiculous things like Black Lives Matter is a terrorist organization, it's just as bad as the Ku Klux Klan, and it's just as bad as neo-Nazis, and it's you guys' fault for what happened at the Charlottesville protests? Like, how do you guys respond to that?
Andrew, thanks very much for contacting us through our app, 1A Vox Pop. DeRay, what would you say to Andrew?
Yeah, so we know that that is an attempt to distract. So when we think about, like, why do we focus on black people, the first thing is that we can focus on the issue around police violence or state violence, and that doesn't mean that we don't care about the other issues. So I can go to a breast cancer rally, and that doesn't mean that I don't care about colon cancer. It just means that I'm focusing on this specific issue in this way. Why I focus on black people is that we know that the disparities and the outcomes are just so bad for people of color that if we fix it for black people, we actually automatically fix it for everybody else. So that, like, that makes sense. I think that the other points, so like, you know, we're the cause of the violence and things like that. It's like, you know, when I was in the street, the only violence I saw was the violence of the police. So like, we wouldn't have been there if the police hadn't killed anybody. And remember that, like, the problem is a problem all across the country. You think about California, 1 in 11 gun homicides in California is actually committed by a police officer. That's like, that's wild. You know, like, this is a big issue. And there are structural reasons that the police never get held accountable. So you think about places like California, where there's a law that says that literally any investigation of an officer that lasts more than a year can never result in discipline, regardless of the outcome. In Cleveland, they destroy police officer disciplinary records every 2 years. In Maryland, my hometown, there's a law that says that you can file an anonymous complaint against an officer for everything except brutality. So when we hear these sort of deflecting, like, you know, why are you guys doing this? You guys are bringing the pain. The way I respond to it is just always like re-pivot back to what the facts are. The second thing I'll say very quickly is I no longer am really preachy about this stuff. I want to have other people explain to me. So, you know, when people tell me that social welfare programs are bad and like, why are we just giving people things? It's like, I ask them, like, what does a 4-year-old have to do to earn dinner? You know, like, what does a 7-year-old have to do to be worthy of shelter? Like, you tell me how they earn dinner, right? Like, I want to hear them explain that to me. Or like people say Mike Brown didn't have his hands up. It's like, should Mike Brown be dead today for supposedly jaywalking? Like, is that a consequence? Or with the police, you know, I'm on a lot of panels with the police and they'll say to me, Duray, there's a lot of crime. Crime's, you know, crime's bad. Are you saying the police should never kill somebody? And I say to them, like, tell me when the police should kill your child. Like, your kid's going to make a mistake. Your kid's going to do something that negatively impacts somebody else. Like, what's the mistake that you'd be okay with the officer putting a bullet through your child's head? And she was like, I don't know. I'm like, well, if you don't know, I don't know, right? So part of our work is to share the cognitive burden.
Much more to discuss as we continue our conversation with Duray McKesson. I do want to talk to you more, of course, about the Black Lives Matter movement, particularly your role within it. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. All we want to do is take the chains off. All we want to do is break the chains off. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is be free. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are speaking to Duray McKesson, the host of the podcast Pod Save the People and the author of the new book On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope. One biographical thing I did want to ask you briefly. You write in the book that teaching was the most important thing you ever did. How did teaching help lay the groundwork for activism?
Oh, you know, it's funny. I like don't think of myself as very old, but I taught a decade ago. My students, those students are like 20, 21 now, which is so wild. You know, teaching was incredible, not only because it was urgent every day, like every single day I had to show up. I taught sixth grade math. Every single day I had to show up and I was math to my students. I had to be as prepared. And I taught 60, 90, and 120-minute classes, which is a whole lot of math for anybody who's ever been around 11-year-olds. What I learned, there were a couple of things. One was like how to take really complex information and break it down into pieces that could be consumed and could be repeated back. So my skill was, like, what I had to learn was not only how to, like, get kids to understand, like, what an equation was, but, like, I had to teach discrete skills, like, you know, when two things touch, it sometimes means multiplication, right? That, like, just how to take apart these big things to make them bite-sized and then have students be able to play with them in a way that they could put them back and rearrange on their own. The second was, like, really understanding, like, what it means to, like, do work that won't have an immediate impact, but will have a long-term impact. So I remember, I'll never forget teaching negative numbers. They struggled. They, like, didn't get it. They're, like, anything lower than zero, they're like, I don't get it. By the end, they could, like, fight anybody around, like, how to solve the most complicated equation, and they, like, deeply understood it. And that was, like, understanding, like, the arc of how to build capacity, and like I learned that. The third thing is that when you think about the best teachers, but the best teachers just walk into classrooms and they know the gift existed long before they got there, and that like our work is to help students understand that they can access the gift long after I'm gone, after the teacher's gone. What the worst teachers do is walk into classrooms and make people believe that the gift only exists in their presence, and like that is, I think, and such a corollary to organizing, that when I travel anywhere where I'm in my own community, that like what I'm trying to do is help people find the gifts that they have because they already have them. They might not know, they might not believe, they might not know how to use them. And that what I can do is help them find them and then use them long after we're gone.
Let's get to some questions about the Black Lives Matter movement. Morgan writes, Black Lives Matter is purposefully without a central leader. So how does he, you, DeRay, how does he view his role within the movement? What has he done to ensure that people know the names of the three black women who actually started BLM? I think Morgan's referring to Patrice Cullors, Opal Temati, and Alicia Garza, who helped propagate the Black Lives Matter hashtag after the Trayvon Martin shooting. DeRay?
Yeah, so when we think about the movement is an expansive space. And I write about this in the book, is that, you know, for those of us who were in the street in Ferguson, we are mindful that there was nobody who founded the space. There was nobody who started the protest. There was no 1, 2, 3, 10 people who called us all to the street, who organized everybody. What was so beautiful about the protest is that it was organic. There were a set of people who came out every night, thousands, who made the protest last. And you have to remember that we were in the street for 400 days, and most people remember it as a long weekend. What's unfortunate is that there's this narrative that has come up that has erased so many people that suggests that there was like a small group of people who started everything, who came to St. Louis, who organized everybody, that organizations did that work. And that's just simply not true. So when I think about like how I use my platform and how I think about my work, is that I'm mindful that I was one of many people. In the book, I highlight so many people who were in the street in St. Louis who did incredible work, for whom without you wouldn't, there would be no protests. So that is important to me. And then the second part is that I know that the platform doesn't only exist for me, that one of the important things about having the platform and access is that not only do I try to make sure that the truth is present in every room, but I also know that I'm not the only person that can bring the truth. So you don't know the people who fed all the protesters every night, or the people who got people out of jail, or the people who helped organize some of the biggest actions, the people who helped to spread across the country. Like, you've never heard those names. And in the book, I try and write about those people too, that I know them because I was there. We were in the middle of the street together. But this narrative that there's like a small set of people who like started everything in the movement, or that there's a small set of organizations who like were the catalyst for the protest, is just not a true narrative.
There's always this tension with movements that have certain people, certain leaders who become more prominent, with the concern about who profits off the cause. I mean, there are some who would critique the book and the podcast as a way to profit off of Black Lives Matter. How do you respond to that? And I also wonder if there is any plan to use any of the proceeds from the book to help the cause.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I think I'm always shocked. You know, I feel like I live a pretty public life, and I'm always shocked by some of the way the question gets asked. So, like, it's public that a portion of all the proceeds went to the NAACP, a portion of all the pre-order sales went to the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. That was public. I did it because it was important, and it was my way of saying that, like, I want you to buy the book, but the book also, like, I want the process of buying the book to also do more work than just buying the book, right? So, like, that's how I think about the book specifically. But in general, in the space, like, I'm mindful of this. And when we started Campaign Zero, which is, like, our biggest project, we started in 2015, we actually didn't participate in the nonprofit funding, like, the nonprofit sort of race for funding, specifically because of the question that you asked. So over the past 3 years, we've raised about $160,000 per year, which is not a lot of money in the grand scheme of nonprofits. And we did it so that we could just raise enough money to do the work that we thought was important, right? So we created the first public database of police union contracts, the first public database of use of force policies, continue to do a lot of data work that hasn't been done ever before, continue to support organizers around the country in really discrete projects. No paid staff. I'm not paid. I don't have a salary from this stuff. So we try to do it as like with just the bare necessities so that it's not this question of like profit. And with the podcast, you know, like the podcast could have just been my voice, but I don't think that makes sense. So I invited Brittany, Sam, and Clint to be a part of it. They get paid as a part of the podcast because I think that that makes sense. And it's not like some, you know, huge moneymaker, but it does allow us to like be able to be in a place where we don't have to rely on the nonprofit complex to like fund our work to do this really well. And you know, it's like the way that I exist in the world right now is like not necessarily a sustainable way.
Not sustainable.
It allows me to like, oh no. I mean, like I don't have, you know, it's like not only do I not necessarily have a salary, but you know, when I quit, it was really rough. It was like, you know, I didn't have health insurance. Like you know, I defaulted on my student loans. Like, it was a really rough, it was rough. Only a couple months ago is the first time that I've actually lived alone since the protest. I've essentially been staying in the basement of, like, my second parents for the past 3 years, right? So, you know, so that's not a, you know, who wants to get married in the basement of their second parents? That's not necessarily sustainable. But it's like, it's the right way that I want to be in the work right now, right? That, like, there are these narratives of, like, oh, I made a gazillion dollars. And it's like, well, no, you, like, see me on the news, you hear me on a podcast, you, like, see me at an event that means a lot to you. And, like, that automatically means wealth to some people. And that's just not the case. Is that I've had high incomes before, and you know that the difference between income and wealth is pretty significant.
Right,
so,
right.
So people have been, like, really confused by that.
Let's talk a little more about policing. One of the members of the 1A Text Club writes, "Police hold a significant position of power in the legal system. They should be held to a higher standard than those without power, but instead they are held to a lower standard and given special treatment and a free pass in our courts and society." Contrast that with another text clubber who wrote, "As time goes on, society will bring about necessary reform, but to denigrate and disregard the entire police force as an institution is ludicrous." What do you think?
Yeah, I think for 2,000 years, we slit people's wrists and called it healthcare. We literally drained people's blood down, and we were like, it's going to drain out all the impurities. And people were like, oh, their blood pressure, like, changed. It's like, no, they, like, didn't have any blood, right? Like, that actually isn't a solution. But we did it for 2,000 years. It was one of the most popular medical procedures, but it didn't work. So if the goal was to save people's lives, it's, like, actually wasn't a good thing. If the goal was to, like, pretend that you were doing good, then, like, this was excellent. And I think about policing, it's like, if the goal is to stop crime or, like, to do any of that work, like, it just isn't, no matter how you feel about the police, that just isn't happening. So you look at the clearance rates with violent crime all across the country, like, the clearance rates are pretty low. It's like the police actually aren't solving the most egregious crimes, which is which people think the police should be doing. But it's costing a lot of money. It's leading to a lot of tension in communities. And at the most basic level, what we're saying is that, like, we should just consider alternatives, right? That, like, this isn't working. If this was a business, you think about Baltimore City, where I live, $500 million invested in the police department, clearance rates pretty low, whole division of the police department just got indicted by the FBI for corruption, and then the civil rights department of the DOJ came in and said their pattern and practice of abuses. Mind you, the highest paid employee in the city of Baltimore is, like, a police officer because of overtime.
Right.
So, like, it's like, if the goal is safety, you know, like, the city just got named the most dangerous city in America. Like, all the money that we poured into it actually isn't manifesting. Is that, like, we know that in places like Baltimore, it's a lot of crimes of poverty and crimes of addiction. We know what to do with addiction and poverty. Like, we could actually solve those things, mm-hmm. But people haven't wanted to. And again, the outcomes with police violence are just so stark that there is something there.
Well, I do wonder, though, about that second text club comment about disregarding the entire police force. That kind of echoes a short voicemail that we received. Here's what Holly from Kentucky left in our inbox.
Help us understand why Black Lives Matter wants fewer police. How does that help public safety?
Holly, thanks for getting in touch. What do you make of that, DeRay, this kind of hashtag not all police argument?
The question becomes, like, what do you want the police to do?
Or actually, I'm sorry. I hate to cut you short, DeRay. First of all, I just want to fact check Holly's voicemail. Does Black Lives Matter actually want fewer police officers?
Well, remember that the movement is expansive. So there's some people in the movement who certainly who sort of think that the level of policing that we have is okay. A lot of people push for less. I think the question is, like, you know, what do you think police officers do? And if you think that police officers are, like, solving the most heinous crimes, it's like that actually isn't happening. If you think that, like, they should be responding to cats in trees and, like, traffic incidents, like, that's actually happening more often than not. So the question becomes, like, where do we put our energy if we want communities to actually be safe? And again, like, most of the crimes that we see in the neighborhoods that we see it in is, like, crimes of addiction and crimes of poverty. And, like, we should actually attack poverty and addiction really aggressively so that we actually don't need a response to conflict, because we can actually make sure that there's less conflict. So when you hear people talk about, like, just more police as, like, a blanket, it's like, sort of, what do you want the police to do? Is that these are the same people who are like, police officers aren't counselors and guidance counselors and social workers. It's like, Well, if you think that the solution requires like guidance counselors and social workers, we should probably invest in those, right? Like that actually makes sense to me, is that if anything, I want more police on Wall Street, right? Like I want more police like with white collar crimes. Like that's what I want. If we have to invest more money in policing, like I'm trying to figure out the people that like broke the stock market and like defrauded all the people out of their homes with mortgages. Like those are things that I don't understand, but like we can do something about addiction and poverty.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A.
We are coming up on 10 years since Bernie Madoff got arrested for his gigantic Ponzi scheme, so there may be something to that.
Like the only person, though. You think about all the people that didn't get arrested, you know?
Didn't get arrested or got arrested and then got out and have kind of just gone on with their lives in one way or another. In the book, you write that, quote, like all institutions, policing wants to convince you that it is permanent, the only way forward, and is in its best form now, unquote. Clearly, you don't believe that that's true. There are some parts of the country that are, you know, definitely grappling with the future of policing. There was the Laquan McDonald case in Chicago, where a white Chicago police officer, Jason Van Dyke, was convicted of second-degree murder for shooting and killing him, a case we spoke about on this show recently. What would you say to people who are generally supporters of law enforcement, who feel that all officers shouldn't be painted with a broad brush, but who might be open to some kind of reform? Is there something, some low-hanging fruit, some common ground that people across the spectrum on this issue might be able to agree on tackling first?
Yeah, so you think about in Austin, we work with the Austin organizers. The Austin City Council unanimously voted against the last version of the police union contract. And one of the ways that they got that to happen is that, like, in Austin, the contract says that an officer who's suspended for 1, 2, or 3 days, the suspension automatically gets recoded as a written reprimand. And, like, that just doesn't make sense, right? Like, you can love the police and still be like, that's just not fair, right? In Cleveland and in Chicago, where there are clauses that say that we destroy police officer disciplinary records, you can love the police and that's just not fair, right? Like, so some of this is, like, some people's entrance is, it's just not fair that you would lose your mind if I told you that at the school system we just deleted every bad thing that the teacher did, like, teachers could slap kids and, like, there's just no consequence. You would be like, that is wild. But when the police do it, people are like, oh, you know, like, that's sort of crazy. And again, like, this isn't part of it, too, is pushing back on the premise that it's like all police officers are bad people. It's like, I don't know all police officers as people. This is a statement about the institution. So when you think about public schools, it's like, when you look at a school where, like, nobody's learning, it's not that you think that, like, every teacher in America is a bad teacher. You're like, what's going on? Like, what is going on in these school districts or schools where, like, nobody, is it a lack of investment? Is it just, like, a lack of outcomes? But, like, nobody is saying that the question's not a worthy question. It's weird that, like, or it's odd that, like, with policing, the moment that you say, like, it's not working, people are like, oh, my God, you must hate everybody. It's like, no, I'm just saying it just isn't working. Like, that's sort of just a true thing. So it's interesting when the people who sort of defend the police get immediately defensive when you are literally just asking for a modicum of accountability. 97% of the officers who are involved in any killings, like, aren't even charged, and 99 aren't convicted. And, like, you saw you heard about the Botham Jean being killed where the officer just walked into his house. Like, that just doesn't seem right to me,
the
right?
Case
and
in
I don't
Dallas
think that's, like, very controversial. Yeah, that just doesn't seem controversial. That just doesn't seem right. You've seen the videos like I've seen the videos. And like, I won't accept that that's just collateral damage of what it means to be safe.
Well, I know we have to pause in just a moment, but where might step one be in terms of reform that people across the spectrum on this might be able to agree on before we have to break?
I think it's like with the police union contracts and with the law, is that, like, it is basic about fairness. And we started this thing at checkthepolice.org so that you can see in your city the clauses that just aren't fair.
So just being more active in terms of what the basic rules are that govern policing.
Yeah. Like, it's actually really hard to find out the rules that allow police officers to shoot and kill people in the cities. It's like, so there's some places where, like, officers don't have to use any escalation or de-escalation, like, to kill people. They literally, right, the first interaction, they can just shoot you. That's why, that doesn't make sense, you know? You can love the police and stuff like that doesn't make sense.
We have been spending a fair amount of time talking about the political. We'll try to talk a little more personal with activist and author DeRay McKesson when we come back. Stay close. Bombs on the floor, smoke in the mirror, girls get their hair done in electric jungle. Back now to our conversation with DeRay McKesson. His new memoir is called On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope. Let's talk about some of the more personal aspects of your life that you describe in the book. There's a short section in the book, like a page and a half, where you talk frankly about your mom leaving the family when you were a toddler and the fact that you never have asked her why she left. Later in the chapter, you write, quote, "I'm mindful that we remember pain and trauma differently than we remember joy and triumph. When we remember pain, we are trying to protect ourselves and cope. We're trying to order the memories in ways that will allow us to make it to tomorrow and to the day after tomorrow," unquote. Talk about how those kinds of traumatic or difficult experiences as a kid kind of helped to shape you as an adult, particularly an adult who would gravitate toward activism.
You know, it's interesting. This is the first time I'm saying this because it just happened, is that my mother read the book and she texted me recently and was like, "Hey, DeRay, read the book. We should talk." And I just haven't, I haven't known what to write back yet. So hopefully I'll write back soon. Is one of the reasons why I wrote this chapter, and the chapter's called I Can Remember Her Now Without Sadness. One of the reasons that I wrote the chapter was that I know that we walk into every room bringing much more than we name. And one of the things that I bring into every room is, what does it mean to be worthy? That if she could leave, then it feels like anybody could leave. And that, like, that is something I've had to sort of work with and grow with as an adult to make sure that that doesn't hurt me or other people. And, like, that's important as we think about what it means to organize, is that, like, we're all walking into rooms and meeting people where they are. And part of meeting people where they are is that we know where we are. And, like, I think that that has to be, like, a core part of it. The part that you read about, like, how we remember pain and how we remember joy, is that for so many people, you think about, like, the constraints. What it, like, people who grew up in marginalized communities, whether it's poverty, race, or any other aspect of their identity, they learn the constraints really well. So I knew how much money we had as a family, and I knew what to ask for and what not to ask for. I knew, like, when we didn't have toys, how to make fun outside. You know, a lot of people talk about growing up poor but not sad. One of the hard parts is, like, when we grow up, is that sometimes we still only see a world of constraints. That, like, the constraints become so great in the way that we've learned how to survive that we can't start to imagine things beyond it. And if we're ever going to win, like, it'll be, like, a deep imagination that gets us to the other side. And, like, you think about the difference between the right and the left is that the right is always repackaging old narratives for a new time. The left, we're always engaged in the most intense make-believe. That, like, we're always trying to tell a story about a world that nobody's ever seen before, but we know it's possible. You've never seen healthcare for all, but, like, you believe it. You've never seen a world where every woman has a right to choose, but, like, we believe that that's real. And, like, telling those stories is actually really hard, and there's no way to be a really good storyteller about a future that you've never seen if you aren't able to tell stories about the world that you live in and how you enter the world.
You also share fairly late in the book the fact that you are a survivor of sexual assault, something that you write happened to you numerous times at a rather young age, and you connect that with what you call the quiet, quiet about the assault, but also quiet about your own identity and your sexuality. You've been out for some time. In the book, you write in part, quote, "I think about the quiet instead of the closet because I've never hidden any part of myself from myself or others." You go on to write, quote, "But I grew up quieter about the parts of myself that I didn't think anyone would love, the parts that I had never seen loved in others," unquote. How does that interact with the person you became?
Yeah, you know, one of the reasons why it was important for me to be out I've been out for a long time, but to be publicly out in a very sort of overt way when the protest began was, like, I didn't want any kid growing up who was also gay to think that the only way to do this work publicly was to be in the closet. And, you know, that chapter started from this tweet that I wrote a long time ago that was, like, just because you didn't know doesn't mean it wasn't real, right? Like, I was in the quiet, not the closet. And, you know, I walk into every room as a gay black man, and, like, that is real to me. It's important. So there was no way for me to write a book about the work that we've done, the work that all of us have collectively done in social justice, or the work that we need to do without talking about, like, my own identity. Now, I wrote about the sexual assault because it was real. It's one of the things that I haven't really talked much about. I mean, it's in the book now, so it's not just, you know, it's not something that only I know. But it was, like, sort of, it was freeing in some ways to finally just say it and, like, not have to tiptoe around it and not be ashamed, but just say that this happened and it was real and it was awful. And, you know, when I finally told a couple years later, they realized that he had actually been sexually abusing like a whole set of kids who were even younger than me. So like, you know, speaking up actually made a difference in other people's lives. And like that was important. But I've had to, like, you know, I write about in the book is that, like, my own relationship to my body, I had to, like, learn that. I had to learn what it meant to be in relation with other people and, like, it be one where we were peers and we both had the same amount of power because that wasn't the first experience with my body, right? So I wanted to just give language to that.
How far do you think that that outness actually goes? I mean, I'm out. I've been out for most of my on-air career, if not all of my on-air career. But I know that there's, you know, there's this aspect of what I believe is referred to as an implied attribute, where it's kind of known but not experienced. So there's a difference between me saying, oh, yes, I'm active with the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association, as opposed to me showing up, you know, a picture of me at a bar with my shirt off making out with a guy in the corner. Like, that's a whole different kind of being out, because people are okay knowing it in the abstract, but they don't want to know that you're actually, like, a gay person who does gay things. And that changes the conception. Do you find that there's a line in terms of identity versus full identification? Like, okay, they know. Let's not say anything more about this. Let's not make them think any more about my identity than they have to be.
Yeah, you know, like, I think we have to complicate this idea of, like, what it means to show up as gay, that, like, there's not one way, right? That there's not two ways to be gay. That, like,
that's why the Pride Parade is really, really long.
Right. That, like, yeah. So, like, sometimes it is me wearing rainbow shoes, right? And sometimes it is me just, like, going on a date and, like, that. And, like, those are both valid ways to show up in the identity that I am, right? So, yeah, there are definitely people who are frustrated with me who feel like I'm, like, not gay enough and, like, that I don't talk about gay issues as publicly as possible. And, like, you know, it's one of those things, too, that it's like, well, how much of my life do I live so that, like, other people can feel like it's real, right? So, like, I know that, you know, we're working with the researcher right now to try and think about HIV testing, that, like, one of the things that some new research suggests is that it's not that people, when people don't get tested, it's not that they don't care about their health or that they're necessarily afraid of the results, but that that they're actually nervous about showing up at a facility in cities that function as small towns. And they're nervous about seeing somebody they went to high school with, seeing, like, somebody's cousin, a friend, right? Like, that they actually are nervous about, like, will privacy really be private?
Right.
And that, like, how do you set up a testing mechanism that gets around that? That, to me, is fascinating. And, like, so we're doing quiet work around that, but, like, I don't feel like I need to talk about that every 2 seconds for people to be like, DeRay actually cares about being gay, right? So the other thing I'll say is that there's some people who, like, are really homophobic but like me, and that's not helpful, that I don't want to be, like, a safe spot for your hate.
You also talk very frankly in the book about your bid for mayor of Baltimore, your willingness to meet with President Obama and with the presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. You write that because of your willingness to engage, quote, there were calls from within the protest community and from without accusing me of political grandstanding and labeling me a sellout, unquote. I wonder how you are finding your way forward in these new endeavors, whether it's politics, hosting a podcast, so in a way you are part of the media, so to speak, and reconciling that with kind of the social justice activism work that you're still involved in. Is that challenging to kind of have a foot in both worlds, as it were?
No, it's like a both and, right? That, like, you know, what's interesting is that all those people who call me a sellout for quote, participating in the system, those are the same people running for office today, right? Those are the same people who, like, are telling everybody to vote, who told people not to vote in 2016, who said that you're wasting your vote, who said that politics didn't matter, and, like, why would you support? I remember I supported Hillary in the Washington Post, and people literally were like, you're wasting your influence. I can't believe you did that. Like, president doesn't have any bearing. This is just for show. And it's like, nobody is saying that now. Like, that was a wild statement to say then. It's wild to say today. So I think that people got it. It's unfortunate that, like, people getting it took all of the chaos that this president continues to put in the space. And you think about, even there were a lot of really, really public people in movement space who literally just would not say anything about Hillary. That wasn't, she was a monster. And, like, you don't have to agree with all of Hillary's stuff to know that, like, she was a better choice than this guy. So that was sort of interesting.
Let me pause you right there for just 1 second. I hate to cut you short, but I want to dig into that a little bit further, because what you touched on, I think, is also one of the issues that especially Democrats are wringing their hands over with regards to the midterms. A lot of the polls suggest that there's real strong activation. But you're right. There were a lot of people who said, it's not going to make a difference. I don't like her. I don't like any of my options. I'm staying home on election day. and it seems like that tide has turned for a lot of Democrats. I wonder how you see it, though. Do you see people more willing to engage in politics conventionally, voting, for example, or do you think maybe Democrats are being a little wishful in their thinking?
No, I think people definitely want to engage. I think the big lesson of 2016 was that, like, just voting against something actually isn't a motivator. I think that younger people want to vote for something. And I think that's where the party is sort of missing the message, is that, like, Trump being crazy, he was crazy before he became president, and that alone wasn't a motivator. He's crazy now, and, like, that actually it still isn't necessarily a motivator for people. For some people, it's a demotivator because they feel like he's so wild that nothing can change. So, like, just voting against him is not, I think that's, like, the wrong message. The second is, like, this was our sort of battle with Obama, is that just telling people if they really care about the country that they'll vote is also the bad message. That, like, there's a generation of young people who, like, won't be shamed into participating. I voted my entire life. I got arrested, tear gassed, dragged out of a police department by my ankles. Like, voting wasn't the panic. It wasn't the end-all, be-all that, like, changed everything. We think about voting as one of the important tools in the toolkit, and it's one of the tools. And I think that that's how we should start talking about it. The second is that we should give people things to vote for. If you're in Florida, you should vote for getting their voting rights back for ex-felons. If you're in Louisiana, you should vote for changing the jury law so that all 12 jurors have to vote to convict somebody of a felony, right? Like, that should be our language. Like, you are voting for in America. When we think about who's going to beat Trump in 2020, it won't be somebody who's running against Trump. It'll be somebody who's running for a vision of America that's bigger than him. That if you just run against him, you're only as big as he is, and we need to have somebody bigger than that.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Speaking of tactics for the future, maybe we should talk about that as we wrap up our conversation. The next to last chapter in the book, the penultimate chapter, is called On Organizing. In it, you argue that the tactics and strategies that served activists in the past don't necessarily help now. Quote, the tactics that were effective in bringing about change in the 60s, 70s, and 80s are well known to all, especially those who oppose them. Unquote. Give me an example of one of the newer tactics that serve activists today that you think has some real viability that people should be paying attention to.
Yeah, so I think that, like, this is a macro comment. One is that, like, we just have access to the internet and social media in a way that we didn't before. So there's a style of activism that says that the only way to be a part of anything real is, like, to be a member, to join a collective, to da da da. And, like, what was so beautiful about the protest, about the movement, certainly about St. Louis, is that you didn't need any of that. That, like, you just needed to come and do work. And that there's, like, a whole organizing tradition that just invalidates that. That, like, says that if you don't participate in, like, an established group and not a member, like, that's the only way collective action can happen. And, like, that, I think that's actually just a really dangerous way to think about organizing. The second is that not that the tactics have failed, but that, like, the other side actually just, like, understands them better. So there was a time where, like, being in a union, like, union organizing was, like, the best possible organizing. It was, like, the most organized. You couldn't go against a union. Or unions remain really important. Their political salience is just different now, not because they're weaker, but because people have found other ways to organize. So we should, like, support unions and union organizing. We should also validate those moms who just, like, set up a organizing thing in their community. Like, all of these are real. And, like, there's still people who say, like, if you don't do it, if you're not trained in this tradition, like, you're not a real, and, like, that's sort of weird. I remember being in the street in St. Louis and, like, there was this narrative literally that, like, people came down and, like, started a movement and founded things and, like, organized all this sort of savage protest. That's, like, still how the narrative is. And, like, what actually happened was, like, we were just like, we don't know what we're doing. We know we're right, though, and we'll figure it out. And a lot of people, like, just had to do a lot to figure it out. I write it in the book about the guy who, the first person who ever used the hashtag Black Lives Matter. Like, he's been just erased from the narrative. And he did it, you know, a year before other people even say they started saying it, right? So, like, how do we just talk about the whole space and, like, let it grow? Like, let other people, like, come in and say what's going on. The last thing I'll say very quickly is that there are a lot of organizers who sort of do that. If you don't do it with me or like me, you're not a real organizer. And that's also really dangerous. So we have to, like, oh, and I say this as somebody who's been in a lot of places. I think I've done good work. I also know that, like, I've gotten messages from, like, 16-year-olds who have had no political training, who have had incredible ideas. And I'm not arrogant enough to believe that the way I do it is the only way to do it, or, like, if people didn't do it with me, then, like, it is invalid. And that actually, so you think about a lot of big organizations really are just asking for your money and your email address. They're right, not building right. your capacity. They're, like, not asking you to do anything that's not with them.
Yeah, and that first person to use the hashtag was a UCLA professor named Marcus Anthony Hunter. I think that's who you're referring to. I know we're super short on time. I want to get to one more quick question from a listener in the West who left this in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Molly in Boulder, Colorado, which is an extremely white town. And I had a white male say to me the other day that black people should get over slavery. I was dumbfounded and shocked by this comment and honestly didn't know how to respond effectively. I told him that it wasn't his place as a privileged white male to say if black people should or should not get over slavery. But I would be curious what Mr. McKesson would recommend as a more thoughtful, effective response to a comment such as this. Thank you.
Thank you, Molly, for asking the question. DeRay, we're super low on time, but I wonder what you would say to Molly.
Yep, two quick things. One is that we talk about truth and reconciliation, and there are a lot of people who want to do the reconciliation without the truth, right? But the truth has to come before the reconciliation. So what I'd say in that instance is, like, again, how do we put the work back on him? Is that, like, you know, like, how do you get over not being paid for centuries of labor? Like, what's the get over part? Like, how do you reconcile, like, not being taught to read and write for generations? Like, what do you think that, like, that's magically, you just magically catch up? Like, having other people explain the what behind that so that you're not just preaching. So yes, you should say, like, that's inappropriate and duh. And also, like, push him to, like, explain the what behind the statement.
DeRay McKesson, the host of the podcast Pod Save the People. His new book is called On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope. DeRay, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you. Honored to be here.
This program was produced by Paige Osborne. To learn more about her and the rest of our team, go to theoneA.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. If you are in the path of Hurricane Michael, please stay safe, stay tuned to your NPR member station, and we'll discuss the storm more tomorrow on the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A. But we gonna be all right.